The memorials continue today for the victims of Monday's massacre at Virginia Tech. And in his radio address this weekend, President Bush pledged a federal review of the issues raised by this tragedy. And that's where we begin this morning with our exclusive headliner, former House Speaker, Fox News analyst, and potential presidential candidate, Newt Gingrich. Welcome back, Mr. Speaker.
George, good to be here.
If you were president today, how would you be responding to Virginia Tech?
Well, I think the president basically has done the right thing, which is to express deep compassion. When something truly evil has happened, I think you have to reach out to the families and the individuals that are involved. I do think it's important to look at the context. Virginia Tech, like many campuses, was supposedly a gun-free zone. In states where people have been allowed to have concealed weapons, in Mississippi and Kentucky, there have been incidents of this kind of a killer who were stopped. Because, in fact, people who are law-abiding, people who are rational, and people who are responsible had the ability to stop them. And
so your solution would be to make guns more accessible?
My solution would be that people who are honest, law-abiding citizens, and the evidence in this is overwhelming in states that have legitimate concealed carry, and in fact, there are states that have concealed carry except on the college campuses, where the campus itself adopts a rule. I would just suggest to you that the professor who gave his life to save a class, who himself was a Holocaust survivor, had he been in a position to stop this deranged person, would have saved an awful lot of lives, including his own.
On the other hand, one of the problems here perhaps was that federal law wasn't followed or wasn't enforced well enough, because several states like Virginia don't share their mental health records with the federal database. Had that been able to come up in a background check, perhaps Mr. Cho wouldn't have gotten his weapons.
Look, that part I totally agree with. It seems to me that particularly when you have somebody where they say that they are potentially dangerous to themselves and others, as apparently the mental health database said about this particular individual, I totally agree that anyone who is, it's a little bit like the law we have gradually come to for pedophiles, where we have very strong indications if somebody is a sexual predator, that we can find out who they are, that they're not going to, you know, be able to be in the near children or be at schools or what have you. I think that a person who is certified by a psychiatrist as potentially dangerous to others, that information should come up and that should block them from acquiring a weapon. Although I'd point out, in the great cities of this country where you have the most gun violence, it is by people breaking the law who manage to buy an illegal gun.
That's true, although Mayor Bloomberg of New York points out that his police aren't even able to access the ATF database, which would give them data on the traffic in illegal guns. Should that be overturned?
I think there should be an ability to look at illegal gun traffic, and that should be something we work out. But I would also point out, in countries that have had absolute bans, Great Britain, Australia, gun violence has actually gone up because the criminals end up buying illegal guns, but the law-abiding honest citizen is in effect disarmed.
How about the broader context? After Columbine, you gave a speech where you blamed the shootings on 35 years of liberalism. You said, I want to say to the elite of this country, the elite news media, the liberal academic elite, the liberal political elite, I accuse you in Littleton of being afraid to talk about the mess you've made and being afraid to take responsibility for the things you have done, and instead foisting on the rest of us pathetic banalities because you don't have the courage to look at the world you have created. Do you stand by that prescription today?
Yes. I think the fact is, if you look at the amount of violence we have in games that young people play at 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 years of age, if you look at the dehumanization, if you look at the fact that we refuse to say that we are, in fact, endowed by our Creator, that our rights come from God, that if you kill somebody, you're committing an act of evil.
But what does that have to do with liberalism?
Well, who has created a situation, ethics, essentially zone of not being willing to talk about any of these things? Let me carry another example. Where I strongly supported Imus being dismissed. But I also think the very thing he was dismissed for, which is the use of language which is stunningly degrading of women. The fact, for example, that one of the Halloween costumes this last year was being able to be either a prostitute or a pimp at 10, 11, 12 years of age buying a costume. And we don't have any discussion about what's happened to our culture, because while we're restricting political free speech under McCain-Feingold, we say it's impossible to restrict vulgar and vicious and anti-human speech. And I would argue that that's a major component of what's happened to our culture over the last 40 years.
Let me turn to the issue of Attorney General Gonzalez. He testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday, said he couldn't remember the key meeting where the firings were finalized. Take a look.
Senator, I don't know that the decision was made at that meeting.
Well, how can you be sure you made the decision?
I recall making the decision for I recall making the decision.
When?
Sir, I don't recall when the decision was made.
Since that testimony, many more Republicans have joined you in calling for Gonzalez to go, but President Bush hasn't budged. Is he being too loyal for his own good?
President Eisenhower had a very firm rule that presidents measured their subordinates by service to the nation, not by personal loyalty. And I think that it is a tremendous mistake, which this administration has made on several occasions, to have personal loyalty transcend service to the nation. I think it's very clear to any reasonable person that an entirely new team at the Justice Department would be better for America, would be better for President Bush, and the sooner that happens, the better.
How do you explain the president's decision?
I think you have to call and ask Tony Snow to do an interview with the president. I mean, you should ask the president how he explains his decision. I don't know.
Let me move on then to another one of his cabinet secretaries, Robert Gates. He was in the Middle East and Iraq this week. He actually said the congressional debate over Iraq has been helpful in putting pressure on the Iraqi government, and he warned the Iraqi government the U.S. patience is limited.
Our commitment to Iraq is long term, but it is not a commitment to have our young men and women patrolling Iraq's streets open-endedly.
He went on to say that the U.S. would have to reevaluate its presence in August if the Iraqi government hadn't made progress on the political benchmarks, the de-bathification law, the oil law by August. Do you believe he was laying the groundwork for an exit?
Well, I think that he's certainly laying the groundwork for saying to the Iraqis that you have a major obligation to get your act together. I would argue, frankly, we also have a major obligation to get the American civilian bureaucracy's acts together, which has been as big a problem in being effective in Iraq as the Iraqi government has been. But I think you always have this. I mean, anytime you are trying to help another country go through a process of very dramatic change and move from a severe dictatorship over here to a self-governing system over here, you're always going to be negotiating and trying to get them to do things that are
effective. But they have missed many deadlines. Would you pull back in August if the deadlines are missed again?
I think you have to look serious. First of all, I'd listen very carefully to General Petraeus and to where he thinks the situation is. But I do think that you have to say that there is not an open-ended American commitment to propping up an Iraqi political system that refuses to make tough decisions. But we also have to understand what we're now describing. If Iraq disintegrates, we have a much more complicated problem in the Middle East. And it's always a balance. When we fought, my father fought in the Korean War, Syngman Rhee was in fact a dictator, a clear, pure dictator of South Korea. It took us a generation to migrate South Korea from dictatorship to democracy. That democracy was fragile. There were coups. We continued to defend South Korea while continuing to nurture democracy. Today, South Korea is both wealthy and democratic, but that was a two-generation cycle. This is actually a more complicated problem than South Korea was.
President Bush has been very stark this week again in laying out the consequences of failure, but earlier this month, on Charlie Rose, you seem much more sanguine. You said no matter what happens in Iraq, the United States is still going to be the number one superpower. And you suggested at least that our security situation wouldn't be all that damaged by what happened in Iraq.
I think that you have to recognize that we have many interests in the world. That the greater question in my mind is whether or not the political will of the United States as personified by comments like Senator Reid that the war is going to give us more Democratic seats, which I thought was frankly as shallow and as cynical and as contemptible a statement as any national leader has made recently. Because the idea that young Americans are dying in Iraq and he's calculating the number of seats he'll pick up just struck me as a bizarre thing for a national leader to say. If in fact the country is prepared to maintain power in the region, and if we are really ready to confront Iran, then I think that there are ways to stabilize the region. But nobody should be confused about this. If we lose the Iraq war, this will be an enormous victory for terrorism. They will all interpret it as victory. The world's news media will interpret it as a victory for terrorism. The world will be substantially more dangerous. We'll still be the most powerful nation in the world. But the world will
but
be substantially
really
more dangerous.
Do you believe victory in any real sense is possible?
For the United States?
Yes.
With time and patience, absolutely.
Let me move on to the prospects of your own victory in a presidential race if you decide to get in. We actually did a poll this week at ABC of the Republican field, and it showed Mayor Giuliani still leading the field, 33%, John McCain at 21%, Fred Thompson and Mitt Romney at 9%. You're in the bottom of the top tier at 6%. I know you said you're not going to make any decision until Labor Day, but there's been a lot of talk about Fred Thompson recently. He was up on Capitol Hill talking to supporters. If he gets in, will you choose not to run?
I'm not going to think about it till the end of September. Let me say, first of all, I think that Mayor Giuliani has had an amazingly positive run, and people should recognize how much his leadership, 9/11, has given him a genuine level of respect around the country. So you'd have to say, for the Republicans, the big news of the last 6 months has been how well Mayor Giuliani has done. I think Fred Thompson would be a terrific addition to the race. I saw him yesterday. I think if he wants to run, he is certainly going to have a base of support out there. As you see, Governor Romney's come up and is doing better than he was a couple months ago. He certainly has raised the most money of any of the candidates on our side. We have a project called American Solutions. We're going to have a workshop on the anniversary of the contract, September the 27th. Our goal is to reach out to 511,000 elected officials across this country. People forget that, you know, the Oval Office is up here, but it's only one office. There are 17,000 school boards, 3,300 counties, 7,200 state legislators, 60,000 cities and towns. If you really want to transform government in America, you have to have a dramatically deeper reach than just a presidential campaign. And so we're really working to develop a generation of solutions on energy, on the environment, on education, on health, on public safety, and then to see if we can actually arouse a dialogue that is nonpartisan, that has people from both parties involved, and that moves us towards a very different conversation than the kind of conversation you're having right now.
So it sounds like a different kind of campaign for
totally
New Cambridge.
Different.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very
Good
much.
Good to be with you.
We were back on the trail this week, this time in New Hampshire.
Be safe, will you?
With Democrat Chris Dodd and his wife, Jackie.
All right, here.
A former Peace Corps volunteer, Dodd has spent the last 25 years as senator from Connecticut.
We need an American president who is ready to lead from day one. There will not be a single day, not a single moment, for on-the-job training.
That experience is what Dodd is selling. And since he can't match the cash or crowds of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, he is counting on old-fashioned kitchen table campaigning. Here in Nashua on Friday, the topic was energy independence and Dodd's call for a new corporate tax on carbon.
Can we still tax them for their carbon?
Yeah, of course you should. And this idea would allow the transition.
At Southern New Hampshire University later that day, we continued the conversation. This issue of the corporate carbon tax that you called for kept coming up over the course of the hour. Are you worried when you talk about taxes that you're leading with your chin?
Well, sure, I thought about that. I'd be foolish to say otherwise. But I don't think you can have a candid conversation about global warming. Everyone gives the speech about how we want renewable technologies and conservation, efficiency, global warming, all of these goals that we all talk about. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Kent, tell me how you get there. How do you get this done? And if you're not willing to be honest about the answer of how you get there, then all the rhetoric about what you're trying to achieve seems rather hollow to me.
None of the other Democrats have called for one.
No, I have, but I don't know how you do this. As long as you have that great elasticity in price of fossil fuels, particularly petroleum, where they can drop that price, as we've seen them do this, making the alternatives less competitive financially, then it's always going to be people will opt for the cheaper product, even though I think most people would prefer to use the more the safer, the cleaner technology and energy.
The country's been consumed this week by the tragedy at Virginia Tech. And I was struck by the cover of Time magazine. It came out today trying to make sense of a massacre. How do you make sense of it?
I think it's all on a very personal level that, you know, I don't have the experience in any kind of police work or anything, but I watched the events unfold, and it was unbelievable to me that at some point someone didn't pick up on this eventuality and do something about it. And there were even people who had tried. But right now, my heart and in my prayers have been the families and the friends And really, the nation is at a time of sorrow right now, that we can't allow our children to go to college and have them in a safe place. And so hopefully the lesson that will come from this is one of those learning moments that, as a mother of little children, I'm always looking for. Hopefully the lesson is going to be that we need to start the dialogue earlier, and we need to start solving the problems before they become so enormous.
The worst campus massacre before Virginia Tech was back at the University of Texas in 1966. And the day after that massacre, your father, Senator Thomas Dodd, called for new gun laws.
The point is that guns are not playthings. I say it's insane for our society to permit this situation to continue.
Will you do the same thing now?
Well, he was a pioneer in this area, and in fact, he started earlier than that. It took the assassinations of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy before he was able to pass something called the Omnibus Crime Bill and the Safe Streets Act. And I've been a strong supporter of gun safety issues, and certainly putting aside the tragedy at Virginia Tech, this is an issue that should be something we're willing to talk about in this country. But I think if we limit it to that, as everyone has asked the questions about gun safety over the last week or so, I think what Jackie's just suggested in answering your question as well, that there are the issues of mental health, of what's on our television and video things. And it isn't just about legislation or regulation. It's having a leader in the White House that's willing to talk about these issues and bring the country and offer some sort of ability to start that conversation about a whole set of other issues.
You don't think the president did that this week?
I think he did it this week, but you can't just wait for these events to happen. This is, I say, that you don't need to have an event to provoke that conversation. It's going on every day. We've got a problem with the coarseness in this country that needs to be addressed.
How about the issue of guns, though? In the past, you've been a strong supporter of gun control. Democrats coming out of other tragedies like this have called for new laws. It's not happening this time, and a lot of people say Democrats are pulling their punches because they believe it's cost them elections, the last three elections. Is that why?
I don't know. I mean, I think, first of all, people are saying, what's going on here? What is about this event? But this wasn't apparently an assault weapon. I gather, and I haven't read all the stories on this, George, that apparently this was at least a legal purchase, someone said to me the other day. So the laws on the books, whether or not there was a waiting period that should have been provoked because of the record of mental illness.
Yeah, there's
and so
some
forth.
Question about whether or not the Virginia record should have been put in the system.
That's existing law, so it's a question of whether or not the law is being implemented. So before someone suggests, in the case, and I don't remember the events in Texas, but I suspect that was before the passage in 68 of these other two bills I mentioned to you, that a lot of these things were just wild going on in the country.
So that's not what you would lead with now.
I don't see. I think there's a tendency to want to ask that question. It's not an insignificant, it's a relevant question. It's just not the only question.
Let's talk about Iraq. Your leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, is taking a lot of heat today for telling the president the war is lost.
Now, I believe myself that the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and you have to make your own decision as to what the president knows, that this war is lost.
Has the war been lost?
I don't think the war is lost. The policy's failed.
But is there a policy now that can truly lead to success?
Yes, I think so. If you're willing to define success as stability of involvement in the neighboring countries in the region, providing some means by which these warring elements in the country are going to find some common ground to sit down on, I think it's harder for people to come together in some instances when you're standing between them.
Which is why you've called for all combat troops to be out by next March.
I think that's why I said it.
For a surge in diplomacy as well. How do you bring others into the process so it's not just the U.S. voice right
but
now?
But why would they come in if we're pulling out?
Because maybe you don't have any other choice at that point. There's nothing like, you know, every now and then saying to people, this has worked in other places. You know, I think part of the thing is assuming, you know what, these guys are never going to leave. You know, to Shias, they'll protect us from the Sunnis. As soon as they'll protect us from the Shias, we can use them to our advantage at various moments. At some point here, setting clarity and saying, look, we're going to redeploy. It's now you've got 300,000 people. You've got 10 divisions, 36 brigades, 118 battalions. It's not the 82nd Airborne. I know that. But they're certainly capable, if they want to, of sorting this out without the U.S. military having to do it for them.
Your Connecticut colleague, Joe Lieberman, says talk like that, talk of a pullout, is doing al-Qaeda's bidding.
Well, with all due respect, I don't believe that to be the case at all. In fact, I think by our continued presence there, adding to this chaos, we're fostering and breeding a generation coming along that it'll be far more difficult for the coming generation to grapple with. because, in a sense, we're radicalizing them in this process. The numbers are just there. They're glaring for us. And that's not walking away. I'm not suggesting, and I thank Jackie for jumping in and making the point here, that you know, when you're attacking Nancy Pelosi because she's meeting with Assad in Syria, why aren't you meeting with him? Why aren't your diplomats meeting with him? When I met with Assad in December, with John Kerry, we sat down. I asked Assad, I said, tell me what you want in Iraq. Tell me what Iraq looks like to you in the most favorable circumstances, a year, 5 years, 10 years from now. He said to me, I want a pluralistic Arab state. I don't want, the last thing I want is a Shia.
Could you believe that?
Well, he said it in English, and as Tom Friedman says, until he says it in Arabic in a public setting, I don't know whether to believe him or not. The fact is, he said it to me. The embassy staff are there. They reported it back in the cable traffic. I'm not a diplomat. That's not my job. But it seems to me when a leader there, with whom we have disagreements in Lebanon and obviously in Israel as well, says that, someone ought to pursue it.
I was struck by something you said at your lunch speech. You said,
you're never going to convince me that the war in Iraq was exclusively about democracy and about Saddam Hussein. It was about oil. Don't have any doubts about it.
If that's true, why did you vote for it?
Well, that I said, I think it was not only about democracy, but it was about oil as well. And there was weapons of mass destruction, the allegations. And George, look, two things people in public life never like to say. I made a mistake and I don't know. And I made a mistake. I wish I hadn't. It's not the only one I've ever made. It's not the only one I ever will make, I promise you. But I did. And you ought to be able to say that.
Your husband's already thanked you for the assist on diplomacy. You worked on Capitol Hill. You worked in the executive branch, the Ex-Im Bank. Mm-hmm. You're working in the corporate world right now. What kind of role would you play in the White House?
First of all, I'm mainly a mommy right now. We have two very young ones. We came to this late in life, but we have a little girl, Christina, that just turned 2, and Gracie's 5 now. And so they take most of my time and energy, and then I do a few things on the side as well, but that's where the real priority is. But I think that the real job of a spouse in my position is to make sure that the home life is completely a safe harbor for him. It's a place that's happy, the girls are doing well, and that's sort of what my focus has been.
I call in a lot, George, and I'll say, well, how are things going? And I get this voice that I know isn't quite as happy.
I tell him it's terrific. It's going really well.
And that's what you're going to be focusing on in the White House, too?
Well, no, that's going to be, of course, that's what I'm going to be focusing on. I think all parents focus on their children first, or at least we should try to focus on our little ones first.
Let's talk politics for a second. You don't register in the national polls right now. Even this morning when I was at that kitchen table discussion, the host said he's not convinced he's going to be for you yet.
Yeah.
Sketch out how this is possible, how you're going to get from here to the nomination, then the White House.
Well, first of all, it's early, and very early.
People don't know him yet. Yeah. When people get to know him, like I've known him for almost 2 decades, it starts becoming more and more clear.
But there's a lot of other people in between.
There are tons of people, and lots of good and honorable people also trying to do this job. But I think when people get to know Chris, they're going to be able to see that not only does he have a great charm and wit and a self-deprecating sense of humor, but he has the intellect, and more importantly, he has the experience. And he's been able to actually do what people talk about doing. He reaches across the aisle and he's done it for his entire career.
But is it possible in this world now, today, running against big celebrities with an awful lot of money, to actually run the kind of campaign that Jimmy Carter ran in 76? I was talking to him a few weeks ago. He said it's not.
Well, I disagree. I wouldn't be talking here today. I mean, we're talking about caucuses and primaries, at least in initial states, that are relatively small in populations. And it doesn't require the kinds of resources we're seeing being raised in certain campaigns. You've got to have some, obviously, and you've got to sustain that. You've got to have enough to be able to run a good campaign.
How are you?
Yeah,
nice to meet you. Nice to see you.
But this is an opportunity here for the country as well as people in the states to get to know you. This isn't being done by TV ads. It's going to be done by exactly what I was doing this morning, and that's sitting down and talking and listening to people. And people want to know whether or not you're electable. They want to know what you stand for, what you believe in. But they don't want to be told the race is over. They're highly offended when people suggest this is only a race about 2 or 3 people, and they've got other candidates they want to hear from.
And you're in all the way to New Hampshire?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's impossible to make sense of such violence and suffering. Those whose lives were taken did nothing to deserve their fate. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now they're gone, and they leave behind grieving families and grieving classmates and a grieving nation.
President Bush speaking Tuesday at Virginia Tech, the day after the worst shooting on a campus in United States history, here to try to make some sense of it after a horrible week. George Will, Sam Donaldson, and Cokie Roberts. And George, we heard the lessons that former Speaker Gingrich draws from this. Which ones do you draw?
I draw sympathy for the administrators of Virginia Tech. To be an administrator of a college today is very difficult. Colleges have retreated from acting in loco parentis with the young people there. And this man was not hardly a child. He was 23. In the late 60s, I believe it was, the Supreme Court said, an opinion written by Justice Brennan, children, and he was talking about high school and grade school children, do not leave their rights at the door. Then we passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, enveloping people with troubles with rights, as is generally right to do. But it could be that under the regime of rights we've now developed, it would have been illegal and exposed Virginia Tech to hundreds of thousands of dollars of litigation fees had they said this man is troubled and should leave our campus.
That's where I come down. It's the mental illness part that I draw the lesson from. And we are dealing horribly in this country with people with mental illness. There were so many warning signals about this young man. And nobody knows how to deal with it because state laws are ridiculous on the subject. In Virginia is one of the states that says you have to be an imminent danger to yourself or others before anybody can do anything about it. His classmates, a couple of women on the campus, were begging for people to do something about him, and they were unable to do it.
Here's the part I don't understand. When he goes into an English class and has such disturbing writings that more than half the class won't even show up
right
the next day, why can't he be expelled from the class?
Well, because of exactly what George is talking about. The college is in a litigation situation then, and it's crazy, not to put too fine a point on it.
If you say this man is troubled and should leave our campus, and he leaves the campus, I fear he picks up a gun and he walks into the bank. You say, well, there are not many people in the bank. Or he walks into a public square or the Mall of America.
Where he should walk into is a hospital.
I think the short answer, terrible. But in our society, with our Constitution and our rights, you're not ever going to be able to prevent totally this kind of thing.
But can you do more to protect everyone else?
Yes, you can do more to protect everybody else. I'm not certain that I worked out exactly how. Was it reasonable after the first shooting to lock down the campus? I don't know how the school administration could have known that this incident, which appeared to be over, required them to lock down everything. How far do you go? I do not believe, short of tightening the gun laws, make it more difficult for these people to get guns. I agree with you. When they show evidence of mental illness, do more to try to help them or help society, if you will. But short of that, I don't know how
he's
ever done it.
His name should have been in the database in Virginia for preventing him from getting guns because he had been certified as disturbed. But one of the interesting things about this whole episode, George, is how muted has been the call for gun control.
Right. On the Democrat side.
5 years ago, Sam, 5 years ago, in Grundy, Virginia, about 130 miles from Virginia Tech, a disturbed person came on the campus, killed a law dean and a student. He was subdued promptly before he could kill more people by three people, two of whom ran to their cars and got the weapons they had in their cars.
Well, I don't want the shootout at the OK Corral going on any college campus, but I do think that the political fact of the Democrats keeping silent on this issue is really fascinating. And you would have heard a great outcry, as you did after Columbine and after other school shootings on elementary campuses, et cetera. But this is a Democratic class that got elected with a lot of conservative principles, and they are saying to their leaders, don't go there.
And they're coming out of three elections, 1994, 2000, 2004, which a lot of Democrats believe guns cost them the election.
But look at the polls. 61% consistently for the last 25 years in everyone's poll, not just the ABC poll, say they want tighter gun restrictions. They're all over the lot about which ones. Gun control. And yet that doesn't translate into political action because of the power of the NRA.
But I think that actually goes to a separate question, though. If you go back 25 years, which you're right, it's been stable. There have been more and more gun restrictions. Some have lapsed. The assault weapons ban lapsed. But I think you look at the facts of this case, and it's hard to figure out what exactly you would call for, what would have made a difference beyond making sure that the mental health records would have been in the database.
Sam, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta studies violence as public health problems and studies it with the tools of epidemiology. And it has discovered, among other interesting things, that every year hundreds of thousands of Americans use the weapons they own. One in three households in America has a weapon in it to deter home invaders.
Now, and to shoot the paper boy and the relative who comes home late at night.
That's the real problem.
That is not a real problem.
The drunken husband is the real problem with the gun.
How about how the media played this and whether or not we contribute to the problem? And I've been struggling with this all week. On the one hand, you imagine NBC gets this package of the videotapes. It's news. On the other hand, every time that something like this is played, and you have a lot of experts who will back this up, they say it validates the killer, gives them exactly what they want, and encourages copycats. Is there any way to deal with this?
I think that it is news, and that you put the news on the air. And they certainly sent up a lot of signals for anybody who was watching at the dinner hour that the children should leave the room. And I think that that is the way to do it. I don't think that we're in the business of withholding news.
Yeah, we don't show beheadings on the air. Should we show the graphic pictures?
But I don't think we showed the poor bodies of the students who'd been shot either, assuming that video was available. It not only is news, but first and foremost, the tragedy was about the people at Virginia Tech and their relatives, no question about it. But that kind of event is something that all of us in this country need to pay attention to. People in their living rooms are discussing, just as we are this morning, what can we do? And the country needs to mobilize if there's going to be new laws or a new approach, or as Newt Gingrich would tell you, a new civilized relationship of society, to talk about it. So to say, well, we can't show this because it's just about them. It is not just about them.
And people want to make
sense
of it.
It's about all of us.
You need to try to, it's so irrational, and you always are in this position as humans of trying to make some sense out of something that doesn't make sense.
But I wonder if looking at that photo helps you make all that much sense. It doesn't tell you all that much about him, and some psychologists say, George, that it actually shows you a distorted picture of the killer. That's not the real person. That's what he wants you to see, and we give it to them.
But it's real about him that he wants us to see him that way. Yeah. And it's hard for me to believe, George, that there's some potential copycat mass murderer out there who will be triggered by that, who would not be triggered by something anyway.
You know, Lee Harvey Oswald with his rifle before he assassinated John F. Kennedy. I mean, you want to look at that guy. You want to see. Now, does it tell me, by looking at that picture, how to solve the problem of another Lee Harvey Oswald? No, it doesn't tell me individually. But I think these events that occur are public property from the standpoint of trying to prevent them in the future. And if you don't have the news out there, I saw in the paper this morning, some learned person said, well, they will always say, you see, the news media, when in fact it just serves the killer's purpose. But that's like saying when terrorists hijacked the airplanes in Lebanon years ago, let's not show it. That's what they want. Yeah, that's what they want. But it's the kind of event that you have to show because you have to do something about it.
The question is how much to show. Let's move on to another big issue this week in Washington. President Bush's stamp on the Supreme Court, crystal clear, a 5-4 decision. The court, for the first time since Roe v. Wade, upheld a ban on a specific abortion procedure. We saw in the Senate immediate reaction.
I'm delighted that the Supreme Court is moving forward to see the expression of life in the Constitution.
The threat on reproductive freedom is no longer theoretical. Today, it is very real.
George, the last time this issue came up, the Nebraska ban, it was a 5-4 decision. Sandra Day O'Connor voted to strike down the ban. She's gone. Sam Alito is in. 5-4 decision to uphold it. But is this decision as momentous as partisans on both sides say?
No. I think a lot of the anger, alarm, celebration even is synthetic on both sides, because this is a great fundraising tool to keep people at a rolling boil. I don't think this will prevent a single abortion in this country, because
Ginsburg said,
precisely, because this is an alternative method.
Then why did they do it?
Overturn it? Yeah. Because this is called deferring to the legislative branch. But their large bipartisan majorities passed that ban.
Except, George is right, President Bush is putting his stamp on the court, but it was not his justice. It was Anthony Kennedy, who in the 2000 decision had voted the other way. Yes, Sandra Day O'Connor might have made a difference too, but he's the one who changed his mind and said, in effect, we justices know more about...
He didn't change his vote. He said there is a material difference in the way the laws are written.
Well, that's true, but he said that more justices know about medical procedures than doctors. That's ridiculous.
Well, I think that, George is right, that the fundraising opportunities and the electioneering opportunities are great here. For Dianne Feinstein to say, you know, the threat is there is a very good thing for the Democrats to go on the road with and to go out for the next election. And it is significant for the court to have made this decision. But I do think that it was very foolish for the pro-choice forces to make this fight. This was a...
Well, this wasn't a fight they chose.
Well,
this was one forced upon them.
But there they were, and they got it as far as the courts, and they didn't need to do that. And the fact of the matter is that this is a particularly grisly form of abortion. It forces everyone to pay attention to all forms of abortion. It was something that, as George pointed out, majorities of both parties voted for. And it becomes something that, you know, you get, you find yourself in an extreme position.
It's an extreme position, perhaps, but those who support a woman's right to choose say the principle is important. If you don't have an exception for the health of the mother.
But people say the same thing about, you know, cop killer bullets, and it's the same problem.
Well, except in this case, it's the doctors who are saying sometimes you need this exception.
That's why they had to make the fight, because of the exception for the health of the mother. If you start down that road, why not make that kind of exception, doesn't matter, in other cases, in other reasons? This is the first time a procedure has been abolished.
And Justice Kennedy's opinion I found, frankly, offensive as a woman.
A little paternalistic?
But I'm just saying that, you know, women would be protected from regrets later in life. You know, there are lots of moral decisions people make all through their lives where they regret them. And the idea that the court is going to stop that for women is something that I think is just offensive.
We're in this mess, in a way, because Justice Blackmun, when he wrote the opinion in Roe v. Wade, discovered something constitutionally and morally profound in the fact that the number of months in the gestation of a human infant is 9, and that's divisible by 3.
Right.
So we wound up with first trimester, second trimester, and third trimester with different rights of the state and the individual in those. Let me ask you a question. What would our constitutional law look like if the number of months in the gestation of a human infant were a prime number? Suppose it were 11.
I never understood prime numbers.
Well, it's a number divisible by 1 in itself. The question is, if it was 11, you couldn't have these completely artificial gradations.
Well, also, of course, the science has changed in the time period since Roe v. Wade.
You and I remember when this show had an ad run by GE, 4D ultrasound, Roberta Flack singing in the background, "The first time ever I saw your face." And the GE said, "The first time you see your baby." Didn't say your fetal material.
Well, and
that's
just
a baby.
Keep in mind, very recently there was all this celebration over a baby who came home from the hospital having been born at, 21 weeks or something? And so we're talking about two things happening at the same time.
Viability is a moving target.
Right. And you think technology is going to take care of this problem before the court has to address Roe v. Wade?
I think technology is going to sensitize us to the fact that that's a baby. And the culture will change, and the number of abortions, particularly late-term abortions, which are fewer than 90% anyway, I mean fewer than 10% anyway, will decline.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you all very much.
This week's Voices and Funnies, brought to you by AT&T. Singular is now the new AT&T.
Our Voice and Funnies this week, David Letterman. In the wake of Virginia Tech, President Bush chose to forego his annual stand-up routine at last night's White House Correspondents' Dinner.
And I was looking forward to doing a little poking myself. But in light of this week's tragedy at Virginia Tech, I decided not to be funny.
But the president was a good sport about Letterman's top 10 Bush moments.
Number 6.
That there be a stable Iran. Iran that is capable of rejecting Iranian influence. I mean, Iraq.
Number 5.
I like to fish.
Mm-hmm. Number 4. Number 3. Number 2.
Doing a better job of talking to each other. The left hand now knows what the right hand is doing.
And the number one favorite George W. Bush moment.
Okay, that's our show for today.